Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. We're supported by listeners, and I'm grateful for the ongoing support of Tom McAfee and Susan Fellows. Susan helped me sort out our recent problems with iTunes, and she gets an extra bow just for that. You want to help? Go to peterbcollins.com. Subscriptions as little as $5 a month. Bruce and the E Street Band opening up another episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. And that song is actually inspired by a comment that John Kerry made when he returned from Vietnam and asked who will be the last to die for that mistake. And it's a question that is relevant again today as the casualties of civilians mount in Afghanistan. And Americans are dying there too. To talk about this, Bo Grosskopf joins us. He is professor of international relations at California State University, Chico, and he is the author of a book published several years ago called Strategic Terror, The Politics and Ethics of Aerial Bombardment. Professor, good to talk with you again.
Thank you, Peter.
And as we speak here in the last week of February, as I referenced, the civilian casualties are mounting, not only in the assault on Marja in Helmand province in southern Afghanistan, but there's an airstrike reported in another province right on the border of Uruzgan and Dikundi provinces, where 27 civilians were killed, including a number of women and children. And each one of these produces an apology from General McChrystal. It produces a statement of outrage from our puppet, Hamid Karzai, who allegedly runs Afghanistan. And while the U.S. and its so-called NATO coalition make, repeated promises to prevent this from happening in the future, it does continue to occur. And you have studied the history of aerial bombardment, particularly where civilian lives have been lost. And this is not inconsistent with American history in warfare, is it?
No, it's not just American warfare, but whatever nation relies on air power as a instrument of war, this is going to happen, which makes the notion of promising that it won't happen again from, in this case, McChrystal or Petraeus, it's a false promise. It's going to happen. Despite all the talk about precision bombing and clean warfare and sharp, smart weapons, this is going to happen. And so these are false promises, but you can understand why they have to make them, because the whole purpose of fundamental purpose of this counterinsurgency strategy is to win the hearts and minds of the Afghan people. And of course, this undermines that effort.
And that very premise, I think, is faulty, and it lies at the fundamental failure of President Obama to recognize that as he boosted U.S. presence by 30,000 troops with the announcement on December 1st of last year. And I think that fundamentally this is an unwinnable situation because I don't believe we will ever be able to separate the insurgents from the civilian population. Some of them are willing supporters of the insurgents, and I use that term instead of Taliban because the corporate media in this country fails to make the distinction between the various insurgent groups that we are attempting to quell in Afghanistan. And they all enjoy support from the local populations. Some of it is blackmailed support because they know that scores will be settled whenever the Americans recede or withdraw from Afghanistan.
Well, they do, but the other point, and I think it's a very good one that you're making here, is that, as is true of any occupation, and it was true of in Iraq, that despite the ethnic differences and often violent differences, the common cause of the Shi'i, Kurds, and Sunni was anti-occupation, i.e. the old concept of nationalism. And this is true of Afghanistan as well. That's why it's not just the Taliban who obviously are problematic, although they weren't problematic from 1996 and 2000 until 2001.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the Clinton administration and then later the Bush administration was very willing to deal with the Taliban as the effective and ruling government, in much the way as a very famous statement was made by a U.S. official: "If we can have good relations with the Saudis, then we can have good relations with the Taliban."
Mm-hmm. And it just strikes me how a smart guy like Obama, who over the course of the campaign and in the first few months of being in office, articulated the very objections that I'm raising now and that others have about the, prospect for success, and I put that in air quotes, in Afghanistan, because we really can't replace the insurgent groups that have provincial loyalties or have strong-armed certain populations. And there isn't enough confidence in the corrupt and ineffective central government in Kabul for us to hope to build up an army, build up a police force that even 5 or 10 years from now could take over from the U.S. occupiers and successfully control that country.
Well, I think there are two things to remember about this, Peter. One is that Obama was not running as an anti-war candidate. In fact, his argument was, as the argument of many Democrats, was that it's the wrong, in terms of Iraq, it's the wrong war and the wrong place. And so their argument was that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with terrorism and that we're supposed to be fighting a war on terror, and in other locations, including Afghanistan, is where we should be putting our interest. So it is entirely consistent with that analysis of Obama at the time of being the candidate for presidency for him to be doing this. If you also take a look at the people that he selected as his national security team, these are not doves. You know, these are very these are people in good standing with the national security state, the military-industrial complex, as Dwight Eisenhower called it. And so this is who he's listening to. The other thing is, historically, a lot of people have pointed out, critics have said, well, if the British can't do it and the Russians can't do it, what is it that makes us think that we can do it? And the answer to that, from my perspective, is, well, we're Americans. And, of course, we have new technology, and we study this stuff very closely. And so, of course, as Americans, we have a can-do attitude. And I think that's also what's behind this.
Well, and this sense of American exceptionalism is something that has been stretched to its limits. And let's just take the attack on December 29th or 30th against our forward base near Khost, where this Jordanian double or triple agent, depending on how you define your terms, was able to penetrate this CIA forward operating base and commit a suicide bombing attack. And while the American media has covered this just from a Homer point of view and kind of lionized this one woman who is a CIA agent and died, she had three children. We don't even know her name, but we know the profile of the story they told us. And so we are supposed to just sympathize with that loss of life and try to isolate that as a freestanding story. But it's not freestanding, because we were trying to get this Jordanian to penetrate the senior ranks of Al-Qaeda and take out either Osama, if he's still alive, or al-Zawahiri, if he could be found, or some of their lieutenants. And I believe this was a surgical strike, which was aimed at sending a message to those who control the drone strikes that have been occurring with greater frequency under Obama than they ever did under Bush, in both Pakistan, where we have no legal right to conduct military action, and in Afghanistan. And people seem to think that these are like video games. They're remote-controlled aircraft that have missiles and other armaments on them. And they do appear to be very precise in hitting a target. The problem is that since we don't have people on the ground, we don't know exactly who's in that house or who's in that car. And we've caused a lot of so-called collateral damage in that process. And it's lost on most Americans the tit-for-tat that I believe the coast suicide bombing represents.
Well, I think you're right. Just your point about why do we know a lot about this woman and the sacrifice that she's made is because, you know, we're personalizing a story about an American who, you know, gave her life for the noble cause. And it obviously makes invisible the policy behind her death and the problems with the policy. As to drones, this is simply another example of what the talk that began, the language that was used in the first Gulf War of being a robo war, i.e., we can fight. This is the essence of air power, using air power to fight and win wars. The rationale: these are clean wars. You know, well, they are clean for the pilots dropping stuff at 30,000, 40,000 feet, but it's very dirty on the ground and for the people on the ground. And this is exactly what we're seeing. Here's new technology where you don't even have to put a pilot at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And the assumption being that, obviously, again, these are smart weapons. In fact, I think the terminology used for them is brilliant weapons, that they can hit exactly what they are targeted to do. And you're right, we don't have anybody there on the ground other than eyewitnesses from the national population. Of course, we don't believe them because they're part and parcel of the enemy. So, it's part and parcel of ways that we use to dodge the terrorism label, and principally by making a distinction between bombing to target civilians, which is terrorism, and then bombing knowing you will kill civilians, which we call war. And thus we get explanations like, well, this is the fog of war, well, this was an inadvertent problematic collateral damage situation. In fact, the new language is regrettable attributed byproducts of the war on terror, which is what they're calling these people now. So, you know, you make a good case about the drones, but it is simply what we call the technological imperative that has driven U.S. War policy for quite some time now.
And there are a couple of points here that I'd like you to react to. One is that I think that while, you know, we look at this as a way of preserving American lives, that it depersonalizes the military action, and that may seem a strange concept because there's nothing personal about going out and killing people on a massive scale. But because we do it by remote control, and because they know that Americans are not at risk as we kill targets and civilians alike, it leaves the impression that American lives are worth some exponential value greater than those that we are taking in these conflicts.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt to that. I mean, that's what we call racism and things of that nature. But that's a well-established attitude and sentiment, unfortunately. even in the language by which we use to describe the other as they're known, whether we're talking about Vietnamese or Asian people as gooks, or Japanese as slant eyes, or Iraqis as sand niggers, or camel heads. I mean, those are all part and parcel of devaluing the other, in this case, the people of color in these countries. And by definition, if you're doing that, you're also, you're also giving stronger identity and therefore value to yourself. And it's a way of making yourself feel good.
Mm-hmm. And Professor, you probably saw this as I did, a remarkable exchange back in November when Secretary of State Clinton visited Pakistan. And she did some unusual public appearances. One was at a university. And I recall this exchange with a young woman student who stood up and very clearly, she didn't even seem to be nervous, explained to Hillary Clinton that the use of these drones to summarily execute people, even if they are leaders of the insurgency, amounts to terrorism. Because these people aren't charged, there is no real investigation. We rely on information that could or could not be accurate from Pakistani military sources and other informants on the ground. And Clinton was flummoxed by it and just retreated into denials and silence. She said, well, I think there's a war on.
That's where she had to go, because there is an imperative when you're fighting a war on terror, there's an imperative to divorce yourself or dodge the terrorism label. You have to do so at all costs, and thus we get these explanations that I mentioned before about the fog of war or accidents or the enemy shielding itself among the civilian population, et cetera, et cetera. That is an imperative. And what this student was doing, or this young woman was doing, was simply challenging that there is a meaningful distinction between bombing to target civilians and bombing knowing you're going to kill civilians. And so, for those trying to dodge the terrorism label, whether it be the United States or Great Britain or Russia or whomever, that's a meaningful distinction. For the people on the ground, it's not a meaningful distinction, and this is precisely what she was saying.
Well, and this, again, leads back to this whole idea of winning hearts and minds, and counterinsurgency requires that we establish some credibility as a protector of the civilian population. And these almost weekly now efforts, sometimes more often than weekly, certainly don't help us in that quest.
Well, it's interesting that you raise that, Peter, because I was just reading a report in the newspaper concerning that the fundamental reason for the surge in Afghanistan that's ongoing is to influence U.S. public opinion, as well as the public opinion relative to, the Afghan populations. And
so this is a PR offensive, particularly in Marja.
This is exactly what McChrystal has stated, and it's written about, I think, came out of the Washington Post today on page 9, of course hidden, but admitting that we need a military victory which will help rally support among the domestic population back here at home for this noble cause, as they call it. But on the other hand, he also says the point is to prove to the Afghan people that we can protect them from the Taliban. Well, in one of my satirical moments, I said, yeah, well, you'll protect them from the Taliban if they're dead. But of course, that's the problem that they're going to have. And the counterinsurgency strategists from NATO or the United States, over the last several weeks when these events have occurred, admit that this is a troubling aspect of using what they call airborne weapons to fight this war, kill civilians, and you do undermine the second part of counterinsurgency. There's two parts of counterinsurgency. One is what they call the coercive side, which is ongoing now, where you try to establish, military victories and try to establish security for a certain area. And then, of course, the harder part is known as the development side, the winning hearts and mind, nation building, whatever you want to call it. And that is imperative that you have been able to secure and maintain the trust and commitment of the local population to this noble cause. Well, there's a problem if you're killing their civilians and all you have is a false promise to explain your way around it, and a weak protest from, you know, your client-backed, the government that you're backing, in this case Karzai, then, you know, you're in a problem area in terms of the development or winning hearts and minds nation-building side of the thing.
We're talking with Bo Grosskopf. He's a professor of international relations and the author of Strategic Terror, The Politics and Ethics of Aerial Bombardment. And in your book, Bo, in Chapter 9, you discuss the term terrorism and the way in particular it has been used in recent years. It's not an accident that Bush created this phony concept of a war on terror, a war on terrorism. And we've seen that in other conflicts around the world, most notably the Israeli attack on Gaza at the end of 2008, that they redefined the Palestinians as terrorists. And this permitted Israel, at least in their minds, to unleash a virulent assault with a 1,400 civilians and Palestinians. Well, 1,400 Palestinians were killed, mostly civilians, and only 14 Israelis. That disproportionality stands out in a stark way. Talk a little bit about your discussion in the book about the use of the term terrorism as a politically loaded concept.
Well, the notion of being politically loaded, and particularly for the issue of terrorism, has to do with concepts that are what we call emotive. That is to say, they evoke strong emotions. And, of course, terrorism, assumed to be and alleged to be the most dastardly deed that one can do to another human being, obviously has strong negative emotive connotations that politicians around the world understand and have used that to mobilize populations around agendas that might otherwise be controversial. If you can separate yourself, I mean, this is very... very important in terms of the Bush administration. It wasn't an accident that he said, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. I mean, it's a black and white world, you know, is what he created for us. And then he announces a war on terror, right, i.e., they're the terrorists, we're not. As terrorists, they're bad. What they're doing is pejorative. What they're doing is negative. So don't raise any questions about it. You're either with us or you're for terrorism. And so that's a very effective use of a politically loaded concept, particularly for liberal democratic societies where we assume that the basis of policy is public opinion. And so if you're able to rally public opinion on your side by using this politically loaded concept, then you're over the hump politically.
In the book, you write, since the early 1970s, the subject of terrorism has been an object of intense, indeed urgent, political socialization. The Western-based terrorism industry has utilized a politicized framework to monopolize the terrorism discourse. As a result, most Westerners, quote, know terrorism is something they do and we don't. In this only if they do it is it to be called terrorism context, labeling U.S. actions as terrorism is the most politically incorrect act one can do. Like past administrations, Bush 2 officials understood this and coded the events of 9/11 in the familiar terms of the ideology of terrorism. And this links now to the whitewashing of the bizarre legal memos written by John Yoo and Jay Bybee that were used to justify torture as an offset to so-called terrorism.
Well, we have a very good example of what I'm talking about recently with Joseph Stark crashing his plane into the IRS building.
In Austin.
In Austin.
Mm-hmm.
And there, I think it was a New York Times article, a researcher who noted how reluctant the particularly cable news networks were to use the word terrorism to describe that, even though by any definition, official definition used by the United States, whether it be the FBI, the CIA, or the State Department, they're pretty much all the same, it fit that. But as a number of commenters, documented a number of commenters, particularly on Fox News said, well, it's not terrorism with a capital T, i.e., it's not terrorism as we're used to thinking about it, because he was an American, first of all, and, you know, he didn't seem to have an anti-Israeli, anti-United States political agenda, which is what we're led to believe in this current war on terror are the terrorists and what they're about. So we're not going to use the word terrorism, they said, and they didn't use the word terrorism, even though it fit every definitional criteria. So that's exactly what I'm talking about there. And there's a set of assumptions that our terrorist experts, without going into great detail about that, for example, the notion that who are the terrorists? Well, they're non-state actors. You know, governments, particularly liberal democratic governments, cannot be part of the problem of terrorism, we're told. So they're people who are trying to disrupt the status quo. Now, there are governments that are associated with terrorism, we're told, and of course, those are the state governments who are either fascist or communist, or the right and the left. But you cannot, and this is a established thesis or theory, that a liberal democratic society like our own or government like our own, it's just impossible for us to be committing terrorist acts.
So the Oklahoma City bombing, was that a terrorist attack? It was a veteran American, a retired American soldier, Timothy McVeigh, who led that. I've never had confidence in the prosecution because I do believe that other people were probably involved beyond his one accomplice, who was also convicted. But in some cases, it's also racist that many people have tried to describe the shooting at Fort Hood by the Army psychiatrist Hassan as terrorism because he's a Muslim and because he had contact with that imam who left Washington and is now in Yemen. So how do we parse these things, and is it always going to be just loaded terminology that's used for the convenience of a moment?
The answer to your last question is yes, because, as I mentioned before, and you well understand, there is a political advantage to being able to do that. And so as long as we have people who are interested in exercising power and getting more power for themselves and understand the advantage of being able to say the other person or entity is, you know, doing something that is, you know, disastrous to the human condition, by definition, they're going to do so. But you know, on the case that you're talking about at Fort Hood, it was interesting. I was watching that. Now that would be a case, and this you heard on cable television, particularly as I watched Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity, for example, which I have to do. And do with great interest. Bill O'Reilly was insistent that was an act of terrorism, and he was insistent because it fit what Megyn Kelly on Fox News, relative to the recent Joseph Stark thing, said was terrorism with a capital T, i.e., it's Muslims with an anti-U.S., anti-Israeli political agenda, and by making those kinds of connections, Bill O'Reilly and others were saying, we need to call it what it is. It's terrorism. And so there you have a perfect case study of what they mean by terrorism, as Ann Coulter talks about it. You know, the only kind of terrorism in the world today is Muslim terrorism.
So the Virginia Tech shooting by a troubled young man was just considered to be that, you know, this was just a crazy guy with a gun. Who was sick and twisted and killed a bunch of his fellow students and teachers.
Well, I'm going to complicate your world a little bit further, Peter.
Okay.
Because the argument would be about whether Joseph Stark was a terrorist or not. According to the FBI, they have a definition, but they add one qualifier, and that is that in order to call it an act of terrorism, you have to demonstrate a conspiracy of two or more people being involved. So if, you know, if indeed it's true that Joseph Stark or the shooter in Virginia acted alone, then according to the FBI criteria of a single person involved in this, then by definition, it's not terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is, if you remember the Unabomber was established by the FBI and all the authorities as an individual acting alone. But if you go back to that time and you look at the discussion, official and media discussion, the Unabomber was a terrorist.
Yeah.
At the same time, the family, you know, the violence against the family planning community, particularly abortion clinics, according to the FBI, as William Webster said at the time, is not real terrorism, which is an interesting distinction, sort of like the capital T today.
And Randall Terry didn't act alone. The guy in who killed Dr. Tiller wasn't really acting alone. He shot him solo. But
yes, except that the FBI says we can't find any conspiracy in those events. We cannot find more than a single individual acting alone. Therefore, it's not terrorism.
Wow.
What you have here, Peter, just to generally, is we have what, you know, my point is, and I think a point of other people's, I don't care what your definition of terrorism, because there's no consensus yet on the concept of how do we define it, even though it's a dictionary. But whatever your definition, some are better than others, but whatever your definition, let's say the FBI definition, it's fine, okay? But the point is, if you know, apply it consistently regardless of who is involved. And what we find is, in all these cases demonstrate, is the pattern of the consistent, inconsistent application of their own definition.
Another quote from your book: when all is said and done, it could be that the debate over intent is really about a difference in degree of intent. Acts of terrorism would be defined as cases of first-degree intent. Other forms of violence, including strategic bombing, would then be, as Mark Herold suggests, cases of second-degree intentionality. So this is an interesting distinction or potential distinction. I don't recall who Mark Herold is, and maybe you want to tell us, but go ahead and expand on this idea a little bit, please.
Mark Herold is a professor in New Hampshire, I believe, who did the study of the initial bombing of Afghanistan in 2001, did a three-month study in which he said his conclusion was that U.S. bombing had killed 5,000-plus Afghan civilians, i.e. more than the civilians who died on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
This is what's called the intent debate or argument. Goes back to what I was saying before about it's not the intent. It is the intent of terrorists to kill civilians. It is not the intent of, let's say, dropping bombs by the United States to kill civilians, okay? And that's an important distinction, what we call the intent argument. And what Herold is raising is that and others, myself included, I just wrote another chapter on this. If you bomb, for example, knowing you're going to kill civilians, then obviously you have an intent to kill civilians. Now, it's not quite the first. This is really what he's breaking it down to, and I tend to agree. It's not the first level of intent, but there still is intent, and that's where that argument is going. So what it does, Peter, is make the distinction between bombing to kill civilians and bombing knowing you're going to kill civilians meaningless, which, of course, as I suggested before, the bombing nations like the United States hang their hat on as an important distinction and meaningful distinction by which they are able to dodge the terrorism label. I would only say that if Iran sent missiles or fighters over to and bombed Israel, a part of Israel, and killed some civilians and came up and said, oh, that was accidental, or that wasn't our intent, we weren't targeting them, and tried to establish that that was a meaningful distinction, that they weren't engaged in the act of terrorism, but they knew that they would kill civilians by using this strategy of warfare. My guess would be for most of us, and particularly for our political leadership, that distinction that the Iranians were trying to establish and hang on to would have no meaning whatsoever. So it's a sort of a double standard.
And as we look at this mostly ground assault on Helmand province in the town of Marja, the American forces going in know that they are trying to take over, civilian populated areas, and that the insurgents are not in uniform, they're not in formation, they don't have tanks, so they're not so easily identifiable. And so they, despite the apologies and the wringing of hands, they know in making the determination to go forward with the military action that civilians will die, and they consider that to be an acceptable result.
Yes, that's the fog of war. At least that's the way they posture it. And, of course, if it were happening to us, if we were victims of such a counterinsurgency strategy back here at home, by an enemy assault, as I say, that wouldn't be a meaningful explanation. But it's always true that the powerful get to control the discourse, and this is the way in which this is a pure example of such.
Now, President Obama has made a point not to use Bush's terminology, particularly the so-called war on terror. Does it make any difference? And when you weigh the tactics and the results that Obama has seen in his first year in office with the 8 years of 7 years of war under Bush, is there a meaningful distinction?
No, there isn't a meaningful distinction. And the only distinction that may be meaningful is the one that you suggested, that the increased use of drones as a weapon of counterinsurgency or as a weapon of war under Obama has increased. There might also be a meaningful distinction in the sense that he has spread the war into Pakistan much more than the Bush-Cheney administration did. But I say that that's simply a feature of his promise or his orientation that says, Iraq really wasn't the place where we should be fighting, and it's these other areas that we should be in. We now know that the United States has been fighting a secret war, both with these mercenaries and with U.S. soldiers in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
Despite, as you suggested, whether or not we have the approval of the Pakistanis at all.
Well, and
is important. The Bush administration used the word, the phrase "war on terror" because it had that word "terror" in it, and that would allow him then to say, you're either with us or against us, and it made sense to much of the American population. Now, there was an effort within the Bush administration at one time to drop that language and call it the Long War, and there was such an outpouring of objection because they understood the politically loaded connotation of terror. The Obama administration quietly has renamed it War on Terror to sort of an innocuous terminology called Global Counterinsurgency. But mm-hmm. again, the word counterinsurgency is loaded as well, but in a positive way, because you can see, we're countering the enemy who's the aggressor. It's the same way as, counterterrorism, i.e., the other side is the aggressor, and we're simply countering. We're on the defensive posture against these awful people. So you can understand that language matters in all of this.
And I guess another measure of this is that Dick Cheney, who snipes at the Obama administration every chance he gets, supports the actions in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Did you say Dick Cheney?
Yeah.
Well, Dick Cheney, Dick Cheney has his political agenda, both in terms of trying to, maintain or, revive the reputation of his 88 years in office. But
mm-hmm.
he has a point of view about, which is that anything goes. And so, that's his point of view. And, You know, it's all based on his 1% doctrine, which I assume, you know, your listeners are familiar with. But if they're not, it basically Dick Cheney operates on, and you can see this in his speeches. He's operating on the notion that if there's a 1% chance of something happening, we need to act as though it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And that was 8 years of Bush Cheney, and that's what that's the basis, really, of his critique of the Obama administration. They seem to be a little bit more measured in terms of how they determine the probability of things happening.
Bo Grosskopf, do you have a blog or a website you want to direct people to?
You know, I really don't.
Okay.
I'm going to retire from the university and probably will become a blogger, Peter.
Well, join us out there on the internet. It's a series of tubes, you know.
Yes, I do know that.
It's great to talk with you again. The book is Strategic Terror, subtitled The Politics and Ethics of Aerial Bombardment. Our thanks to Professor Bo Grosskopf.
Thank you, Peter.
Good to talk to you. We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show, sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to drink organic. Try the fine earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. Just click on the link on my homepage for a very special offer for you from the Organic Wine Company.
Psychic spies from China try to steal your mind's elation. And little girls from Sweden dream of silver screen quotation. And if you want these kind of dreams, it's Californication.
I'm waiting for the Chili Peppers to come out with Carly Fornication. We'll explain.
It's the edge of the world in all of Western civilization.
Well, not quite.
The sun may rise in the east, at least it's settled in a final location. It's understood that Hollywood sells California.
Joining me now for an update on California politics and some of the election campaigns that are underway this year is Robert Cruikshank. He works for two different outlets that you should be aware of. One is the Courage Campaign on the web at couragecampaign.org. And we'll also talk about what I think is one of the most interesting and influential blogs in California politics over the last few years called Calitics, where Robert posts like a son of a bitch, like every day or more. Robert, welcome to our program today.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Peter.
Well, it's good to talk with you, and I admire what you're doing. Let's start with the Courage Campaign. Give our listeners, particularly people outside California, a little idea about who is the Courage Campaign and what issues you focus on.
Well, the Courage Campaign is a California-focused online organizing outfit. We're kind of a California version of MoveOn.org, which I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with. And we task ourselves with the goal of making California more progressive and more governable. You know, we have a lot of problems here in California, from our state's economic and political crisis to the fact that we routinely seem to vote to deny people basic rights. There's a lot of progressive things that need to be done here in the nation's most populous state, and the Courage Campaign exists to help achieve those progressive goals.
And what are the tools that you use? You've got a powerful website, but you've also built a grassroots base. Is that right?
Yeah, we have an email list of over 750,000 members spread throughout California and even throughout the country. We also have a number of on-the-ground field teams that are organizing in their communities to help produce progressive change. We've so far got over 25 of those teams, and we're looking to grow that number substantially in the coming months.
And you're the communications director for Courage Campaign?
Well, I'm the public policy director for the Courage Campaign, which
okay.
means I have a lot of different tasks, one of which is to keep in touch with what's going on here in the state. But I also do a lot of the online communications for the organization as well.
And some of the stuff you write for Courage Campaign is just posted at Calitics. Is that right?
That's right. Calitics is the one of the leading blogs covering California politics. We're a progressive blog, and a lot of what I write there, I'll you know, feed to the Courage Campaign website as well. And a lot of the issues that come up at Calitics will make their way into a Courage Campaign online action, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now let's give people an example here. Meg Whitman is the billionaire who made a fortune at eBay, and she's trying essentially to buy the governorship. And she's been running a very stealthy campaign somewhat modeled on the way the Republicans handled Sarah Palin, which is to say, hide the candidate, never let her talk to the press because, gosh, they might ask her a question she's not prepared for. She's finally agreed, after being a candidate for almost a year, to do a debate with her badly trailing Republican opponent, Insurance Commissioner Steve Poizner. But she has avoided, when Tom Campbell was in the race, he's a very bright guy, well-schooled on the issues and a good debater. She would not appear in the same forum with him. So we're now seeing, after they spent a bunch of money on a long-running radio campaign, mostly on conservative talk stations in the state, she has surfaced now with her second TV ad. And the ads are what I would call blue sky and quite deceptive, because she really, you know, tries to play on people's fears and then present an image of California as a happy place with Ferris wheels and stars in the sky. And it's kind of bizarre how they are trying to frame the campaign, yet Republicans seem to be responding favorably to it.
Well, they are, and I think Republicans respond favorably to someone they think they can win. This is the one thing to keep in mind about Republican politics. We tend to think of it as a highly ideological party that has all sorts of litmus tests and purity fights. But, you know, when it comes down to it, they want power, and they will fall in line behind whomever they think will get them into power or to hold power as quickly as possible. In this case, it's Meg Whitman, even though her opponent, Steve Poizner, in the Republican primary is a more dogmatically conservative candidate. They're shunning him because they don't think he can win.
And he's not a pauper. He's a guy who decided to establish himself statewide in the insurance commissioner post. He's the only Republican. Well, I'm sorry, Schwarzenegger. I forgot about him. But they're the only two who won statewide in the last cycle. And Poizner made his money on GPS technology and cell phones. And he routinely helicopters from his home in San Jose to his job in Sacramento. And he's a slash-and-burn guy. He's hired some real gutter fighter consultants. And yet he hasn't been able to make any headway, even though, as you say, he has much more of a provable track record as a red-meat right-winger.
Well, again, I think it's because the Republican base understands that they want to win above anything else, and they will hold to their principles as long as they can until someone else comes along who can get them back into power, or in this case, to hold on to the power they already have. You know, we think of the Republicans as this principled group. They're really not. They are totally out for the money, completely out for power, and any principle or belief they hold is secondary to those other motives.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things is that Whitman basically ignores the debacle of Arnold Schwarzenegger. I mean, he's really almost a complete failure. The only bright spot was the global warming legislation, AB 32. But even that now is kind of falling apart, and there's an effort to essentially neutralize it at the ballot box through an initiative. And yet, you know, we've had this guy having on-the-job training. Schwarzenegger's not stupid, and I give him credit for being a quick study. He did that to learn his lines in Hollywood, and I think he learned his lines in Sacramento as well as he could. But he's been a total failure. He's taken us off the brink economically, and she seems to think the answer is another person who's not a quote-unquote career politician. But she's a woman who has a spotty record even in voting in public elections. She has no experience in politics or legislation whatsoever, and she makes these very broad claims about how she's going to fix California by cutting spending, by not raising taxes but creating jobs, and she doesn't describe how she's going to do that. And then after she cuts revenues to the state even further, she claims she's going to fix education. It's all pretty bizarre and incoherent.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense at all. The numbers simply don't add up. Meg Whitman, as a corporate CEO, really seems to want to bring CEO democracy, so to speak, to California, where, you know, you do mass layoffs of everybody so that the corporate CEOs can make more money. That's essentially the plan here in California. where she pledges to lay off 40,000 public workers across the board. That will include teachers, nurses, firefighters, people who run the vital public services that keep our state going. She seems to think higher unemployment is what California needs, even though we have the highest unemployment the state has seen in 60 years.
And in a recent post, Robert, you put a number on it, that laying off 40,000 people would only save the state $2.5 billion. The current budget's about $85 billion. The reported gap is about $20 billion. That won't do very much.
It won't do anything. It's a drop in the bucket. The only way we preserve the services that keep California's economy functioning, to keep our children educated, to make sure that our elderly and disabled people have the health care they need, is to find new revenue to support that. We should follow the example set by our neighbors to the north in Oregon, where they raise taxes on corporations and the wealthy to do that. Whitman's whole approach to politics, her whole campaign, is based on an effort to prevent that from happening here in California. She sees her job as slash and burn of all the public services that Californians defend and like and value in order to prevent tax increases on the wealthy, which are inevitable unless we destroy what's left of our public services.
Well, and starting with Governor Norquist, we have a group in California of suicidal Republicans who are so committed to an ideology that makes no sense, even, you know, even more so in the current economic climate. Yet they're willing to strangle the state or drown it in the bathtub, as Grover likes to say, and damn the consequences, because they represent people who are they've got theirs. They're going to be okay. Even if the state and the services it should be providing go down the tubes.
Well, I think that's right. And if you see the way Arnold Schwarzenegger has played out in practice, you'll see what's going to happen to Meg Whitman. Arnold passed himself off as a fairly moderate candidate, both in the recall vote in 2003 and in his reelection bid in 2006. In practice, he's governed from the right. His fiscal policies have been very deeply conservative, very deeply right-wing. Part of that is because the Republican Party in Sacramento, which holds power even though they don't have a minority. They hold power because of this silly rule we have requiring a two-thirds vote to approve a budget or to raise taxes.
Which facilitates minority rule.
Exactly. And the minority Republican Party is very highly ideological. They're very right-wing. And what they do is they absolutely refuse any new revenues, no matter how badly they're needed. And the governor has always fallen in line behind them. Meg Whitman will do exactly the same thing. Especially because Whitman is proposing further tax cuts, and she's been endorsed by some of the leading right-wing organizations in the state, including the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, sort of a California version of Grover Norquist's group.
Now, at Courage Campaign, you're doing some interesting things. Meg Whitman started off with this radio campaign that I referred to, and you have a radio spot that I think raises some interesting counterpoints. Let's play that for our listeners right now.
There is something rotten in Denmark. At the climate change conference in Copenhagen, world leaders, including President Obama and Governor Schwarzenegger, are working on real solutions to global warming. But Meg Whitman, who wants to be governor of California, is standing with Sarah Palin and a group of extreme right-wingers in attacking solutions to the climate crisis. Whitman wants to reverse California's groundbreaking effort to address global warming. Stopping a measure, Governor Schwarzenegger went to Copenhagen to defend. Why do out-of-touch ideologues like Sarah Palin and Meg Whitman oppose common-sense solutions to stop global warming? Talk about going rogue. Go to couragecampaign.org to learn why Meg Whitman is California's Sarah Palin. We don't need another extremist going rogue on Californians. Paid for by the Courage Campaign.
Now, I think that's very effective on a number of levels, and I appreciate the, because I started off with the parallels between the campaign styles of Palin and Whitman. I guess the only thing that Whitman doesn't do is hold press conferences at Facebook.
Yeah, that's true. I think you hit on it earlier when you mentioned that, like Palin, Whitman is very carefully stage-managed, hides from the press, wants to control her image very tightly, wants to control her message even more tightly. You know, when we put that ad out, we got some feedback from some people saying that it was a questionable comparison because Meg Whitman isn't a complete moron the way Sarah Palin is. And while that's probably true, the point we tried to make, and I think we did so effectively, was that their ideologies are exactly the same. Their solutions for California and the country are exactly the same. These are hard right-wingers who want to destroy the progressive achievements of our state, particularly when it comes to global warming. Meg Whitman thinks we should not do anything about global warming, thinks we should repeal AB 32, and if the sea levels rise and we have more droughts and fires, I guess her view is damn the consequences.
Well, a lot of her money's offshore anyway.
That's true. I mean, she's apparently hiding a significant amount of her wealth in offshore tax havens, including the Cayman Islands.
Yeah.
So, you know, and she's resisting releasing her tax refund or tax her tax statements, her tax return, because she doesn't seem to believe that someone like Meg Whitman, who wants to be a public servant, should have to disclose anything to the public.
Robert, the other thing you've done at Courage Campaign is produce a very low-cost but highly effective video piece that, if you raise the money, will be placed as a commercial on perhaps cable or broadcast TV outlets. And it is a series of scenes, and this is something that we can't really play effectively on the radio, but I will link to it in the show file regarding this podcast so that people can go to your website and take a look at it. But you just show a series of scenes, starting in a hospital, and then we see parks and city halls and court buildings and police headquarters. And in each one of them, you very simply but effectively have a citizen standing there with a handwritten sign that says closed. And this is a very powerful message that shows the real-life implications of Republican budgeting.
Well, that's exactly what it is. It's a sign, literally and figuratively, of what's going to happen in Meg Whitman's California. If she does become the next governor, she's able to implement her plans and ideas. She is going to make these massive cuts, as we described earlier. She'll have no other choice given her desire to cut taxes further and her belief that spending is the reason why California's in crisis. So what we wanted to do is go out there and tell a different narrative than the one Meg Whitman is telling. We wanted to show what Whitman's actual proposals and actual beliefs will lead to. And what we wanted to do is show Californians that this isn't about some abstract government spending. This is about the very basic public services that we've had for decades, even centuries in this state, from our beaches to our libraries to our schools to the health care services that keep people on kidney dialysis alive. Those are the things that Meg Whitman is going to cut, slash, and close. That's her policy for California. We believe that the people of California need to know that. They're certainly not hearing that in Whitman's feel-good ads. They don't make any mention of her plans to close all of these public services down.
And Robert, just as a friendly suggestion, I have a little tune here I'd like you to listen to part of, because I think this would make an excellent soundtrack. You have just some kind of nondescript music behind this, the spot we're talking about. But this is a guy named Richard March.
They're closing all the libraries. They're closing all the libraries. They're closing all the libraries. They're locking hello doors. They're closing all the libraries. Doubling my parking fees. They're building prisons in old schoolyards.
So Richard March is a singer-songwriter from Sacramento, and I'll bet you he'd license that tune to you for a nickel or a little more.
Yeah, that's a fantastic tune, and I think it tells the story of Meg Whitman's California very, very clearly.
The other thing that she's doing, and this is not in the TV spots, but was in at least one of the radio commercials I heard, is a reprise from the Ronald Reagan playbook of playing off class warfare, class issues, and demonizing welfare recipients. And at a time like this, when there is very little job opportunity and when the job cuts have hit the hardest at the entry level and the low pay level, it's really cruel to go on television and to, well, again, let me restate that because I just said it wasn't on TV, but to go on radio and to pander, particularly to right-wing talk audiences, with this phony notion that there are huge amounts of money being sucked away and frittered away by deadbeats in our society. And at a time like this, it's not like I feel that we need to subsidize deadbeats. I think we need to recognize that there are a lot of people who are stuck, who can't get the higher education or job training that they need because of the massive cuts in education, including at the state college level that we've seen in the past 3 years. We have disinvested in K through 12 education. So the people coming out of high school today who are among those who can't get into community colleges because of the cutbacks in enrollment really have no place to go. And so I think that this is something that is probably very effective with likely Republican primary voters.
Well, I think that's probably correct. But as we know, this notion that welfare recipients are somehow the problem in California is just not true. I mean, I don't see how you can ask someone on any form of public assistance to go get a job when we have no jobs to give.
Yeah.
There are people out there who've been unemployed for, you know, months, even years, who would desperately love a job, who aren't on any form of public assistance. They're trying to make ends meet however they can. They'd love a job. They're not out there. They don't exist. The reforms that were done in the 1990s under Pete Wilson to welfare really scaled back dramatically the effectiveness of public assistance. It made the rates of child poverty and child hunger go through the roof here in California. And in fact, we pay, in terms of monthly assistance, people on CalWORKs, which is a California welfare program. They get paid less a month here in 2010 than they would have received in 1989.
Yeah.
Even though we have a larger population and our state budget is much larger than it had been in 1989. But Whitman is pandering to the Republican base on this as part of her effort to deflect the real reasons why the state is in a budget crisis. We have any number of tax breaks for wealthy people and billionaires. And large corporations, they don't pay their fair share any longer. The top 1% of income earners here in California pay a smaller share of their taxes to state and local governments than do the bottom 20% in California. We have a regressive tax system. Whitman is there to defend that regressive tax system. She's there to prevent her wealthy friends and CEO allies from having to pay their fair share to keep her schools open, to put people back to work, give people the health care services they need.
And so what is the current tab of how much of her fortune she's put into the campaign and how much she has raised from corporate cronies like Mitt Romney and his pals?
Well, it's unclear how much she's raised from those pals, but she's put about $39 million of her $1.4 billion fortune into this. She said in the past she's willing to spend up to $100 million of her own money to win this election. I wouldn't be surprised if that number grew as the election season continues. If she's spent almost $40 million so far, and we're only at the end of February of 2010, you know, she could be pushing $200, $300 million by the time November rolls around.
Now, before we leave the governor's race, there is a Democratic candidate. There's no primary contest because the only real challenger to Jerry Brown was John Garamendi. And in full disclosure, I worked as a consultant to Mr. Garamendi as he made the decision last year to get out of the governor's race and run for the open congressional seat, which he handily picked up in November of last year. And I supported Garamendi because among Democrats, he was the most honest about the phony budgets that have been passing through the legislature and approved by the governor in the last two cycles. And in particular, he fought hard to maintain the investments in education, particularly at the University of California and the California State University systems. Jerry Brown so far has failed to announce a campaign or his candidacy. He widely expects to announce that in the next 3 to 4 weeks. He has to file officially by mid-March. But you even got quoted in the right-wing, the token right-wing column in the San Francisco Chronicle today, Deborah J. Saunders, picked up a quote from you as she was adding to the echo chamber of "Where's Jerry?" But as a progressive, you do have some valid criticisms of Jerry's strategy, which is to lay low, coast through the primary, and hope to kind of like Apollo Ono, come from the rear and close in and defeat her at the very last lap.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that's going to work. That concerns me, as it seems a little too close to the Martha Coakley strategy that we saw in the Massachusetts Senate election back in January, where she thought she could just coast to victory in that election. And Scott Brown went out and ran a very good campaign, was very well organized, had a good message that he blanketed Massachusetts airwaves with, and he won that election. The concern I have is that Jerry Brown might be doing the same thing here in California. Jerry Brown has been around for a while in California, but he hasn't run a major statewide campaign like this in almost 30 years. He did run a statewide campaign in 2006 when he got elected attorney general. That was a much lower profile race against only token opposition, certainly no one of Meg Whitman's stature.
Yeah, he didn't have to spend much money, and he coasted in on name recognition and older voters.
Well, that's right, and I worry that Brown may feel that the same thing can happen here. He has an opportunity, however, to really build a powerful campaign to, you know, build California for the next 30 years, to fix what's broken in our state. I think there's still a lot of goodwill left towards Jerry Brown. He's seen by many as a last link to California's real glory days of the 1960s and 1970s. And, of course, he was governor in the late 1970s during a lot of that. There's a lot of people out there who want Brown to win and want to go out and help organize for Brown and want to start working for Brown. He needs to get out there and start countering Meg Whitman's messages by telling people how he'll fix California, by selling a progressive message of reinvesting in our public institutions, our schools, our healthcare programs, our public services such as libraries, fire departments.
He's been totally on the sidelines in the budget battles, even when he moved out of the mayorship of Oakland and back into statewide office as attorney general. Now, I know the AG doesn't have an actual role in the budget process, but since he decided to run for governor and made that clear over a year ago, he could at least offer some ideas of what he would do to fix these serious fiscal problems. But he's ducked that, and he fires off press releases almost every day about what he's doing as attorney general. But nobody knows what Governor Jerry Brown, Part 2, the sequel, would actually be like. And so it's a faith-based phenomenon, at least to date.
Yeah, and I think that's a problem, particularly because Brown has a reputation of being able to run very populist type of campaign. When he ran for president in 1992, he captured a lot of energy and momentum behind his populist campaign, which embraced, among other things, single-payer health care for the United States. Back in 92, Bill Clinton had more money and more momentum, and Brown wasn't able to make a go of it. But if we saw that kind of Jerry Brown, who could bring some real anti-corporate populism to the budget battle, if he were to come here and repeat the solutions of the state of Oregon, as I mentioned earlier, where voters overwhelmingly supported raising taxes on the wealthy and on large corporations to keep their schools open, you know, that's a winning message here in California. We've seen poll after poll after poll that shows Californians want to have corporations and the wealthy pay their fair share so that we're not laying off teachers, so we're not closing schools, we're not cutting library hours, so we're not kicking kids off of health care programs. Nobody wants to do those sort of things.
Yeah.
And that's where Jerry Brown can really step in and offer a very clear and compelling message that can counter what Meg Whitman is offering and really rally people to his side.
And he's basically running a very safe approach to this. For example, as Attorney General, he has latitude and prerogatives to unilaterally reduce the prison population and cut the costs. We spend more on prisons than we do on higher education now, and that's a source of great shame to me. But, for example, some of the most costly prisoners in the system are lifers who were sentenced when he was governor in the 1970s, and who are still there because the parole board has been politicized to avoid any Willie Horton on anybody's watch. And we now have 70-year-old inmates who cost well north of the average cost because of their health care needs, and they could be paroled without much risk to public safety. Lifers reoffend at the lowest rates, and they're in single digits in most cases. And, he just keeps blocking their release through endless appeals and by essentially supporting Governor Schwarzenegger's use of his under Proposition 8 many years ago, not the one that banned gay marriage, but there was a Prop 8, I believe, in the mid-80s that gave the governor the last choice of whether to accept a parole recommendation from the parole board. And that has been widely abused. Gray Davis did that. He refused to release prisoners as much as possible. And Schwarzenegger, initially when he came to office, was reasonable on parole. But once the prison guards union got to him, he changed that. And Brown has been a player in maintaining a really hard stance against releasing these aging prisoners.
Well, that's right, and that's really unfortunate because it's a sign that Brown really does need to recognize it's not 1978 anymore. We don't need these old-school law and order politics, lock them up and throw away the key. That doesn't really motivate voters anymore. There is widespread support for sentencing reform. There's widespread support for things like legalizing marijuana. There will be an initiative here on the California ballot in November to do exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
Brown has opposed drug policy reform in the past. He's opposed sentencing reform in the past. And it's really nonsensical, partly because the fact that there are so many people overcrowding California prisons because of the health care costs that the state doesn't want to pay for these lifers. The federal courts are going to order prisoner releases anyway. So Brown is missing an opportunity to do this sensibly, to have a reasonable method of dealing with our prison crisis by being so inflexible about sentencing reform, about drug policy reform, about prison reform.
You make a good point. The federal courts have ordered California to reduce the prison population by more than 40,000. And last September, the governor called a special session to try to come up with some plan to do that. And it was Democrats, most of whom have aspirations for higher statewide office, Democrats in the legislature who balked at any sensible, reasonable approach to reducing the population by sentencing reform or by reforming the parole process.
Yeah, and this speaks to something that I don't think Democrats understand enough here in California. They seem to think that if they can put off the tough decisions that have some risk to them, that they'll benefit in the short term. And that's just not true. These prison costs make the state budget deficit grow wider. And the first people who get hit by that state budget crisis politically are Democrats. It makes Democrats look bad. It makes it more difficult for Democrats to win the governorship or other statewide offices because Republicans now have a reason to say that Democrats are mismanaging the state budget. We have too much spending. We need to cut it. These Democrats need to understand that it's only to their political benefit to provide some lasting solutions to these kind of problems.
Robert Cruickshank is with us here on the Peter B. Collins Show, Calitics.com and CourageCampaign.org. Now I want to move to the Senate race because Republicans are focused on trying to unseat Barbara Boxer, one of the most liberal members of the United States Senate, as she seeks a third term. And we have another Silicon Valley millionaire, she's not a billionaire, Carly Fiorina, who was the failed CEO of Hewlett-Packard, the first woman to head that company. And they brought her in, and she lasted a few years. Her big play was to merge with Compaq, C-O-M-P-A-Q, a name that nobody remembers now. And it was a huge failure, and she was drummed out by a dissident board member who plotted against her with secret phone calls. And, there was a big scandal about that. But the bottom line is that she can't even claim the level of success that Meg Whitman does as a businesswoman. And she's coming in like with a machete, attacking Tom Campbell, who moved from the governor's race over to the Senate race when it became clear he couldn't compete with Meg's money. And in full disclosure, Tom Campbell is a friend of mine, and I worked as an advisor on his failed Senate campaign in 2000 when he challenged the nominal Democrat, Dianne Feinstein. And I like Tom. I don't support him in this race because Barbara Boxer is too important as one of the few liberal voices in Washington, and I value that. But I remain friends with Tom, and we communicate from time to time. The attacks that Carly Fiorina is making on him are very Karl Rovian. They are trying to attack Campbell on his strengths. And he's got a law degree and a degree in economics. He's a brilliant guy. He knows the state budget inside and out because he took a year off from academia to serve as Schwarzenegger's finance director. And he has had the poor judgment to recognize the problem with the California budget and call for what he called short-term tax increases on gasoline. And he's now being pounded for that as, what is it, a fino-fiscal in name only? What fiscal conservative, F-C-I-N-O, right?
Yeah, fiscal conservative in name only. And Fiorina unveiled that in what has been universally hailed as one of the worst campaign ads ever produced, starring this demon sheep stalking this herd of actual sheep. It was a man.
Well, let me just stop you for a moment, Robert. Robert, because it's unfair to call it a campaign ad, and that's an insult to some of the good campaign ads or even bad ones that have been made over the years. It's a 3.5-minute home video that is just an attack piece, and it was concocted with a bizarre, you know, sheep scenario. And they hit Campbell for being a gentleman, for being a guy who values good government. They basically just ridiculed him for the very things that people respect him for.
Well, that's right. And that's, you know, the Fiorina campaign. They really have nothing else. The fact that Carly Fiorina ran one of California's great companies, Hewlett-Packard, into the ground is something they're trying to avoid. So they're taking these Karl Rove-style tactics and going after Tom Campbell, someone who polls very well in the Senate race. You know, I think the real issue here, aside from Fiorina's complete incompetence both as a campaigner and as a CEO, is her love of layoffs. You know, Fiorina laid off tens of thousands of people at Hewlett-Packard, destroying a lot of the company's value and making it more difficult for them to offer the products that they used to offer. And when she did so, she said that, you know, this sort of mass layoff is a good thing for America. It's healthy to offshore jobs. She called it right sourcing. She said Americans don't have a God-given right to a job anymore. You know, this is what she wants to bring to the United States Senate. She and Meg Whitman both believe that higher unemployment is good for the country, good for the state, apparently because it puts more money in the pockets of themselves and their wealthy friends.
Yeah. And because she and Whitman have no political track record, and like Whitman, Fiorina has a very spotty voting record as a citizen, it's hard to prove that either of them ever really voted in California. You know, she is free to attack, and she has no political baggage that anybody can hit her back for.
Well, that's right, and this is, you know, an unfortunate piece of people coming out of the corporate world. You know, they're so used to essentially getting their way and not being held accountable. That's certainly something that groups like the Courage Campaign and other organizations in the state are going to do, going to hold these candidates accountable so that people understand what they really believe and where they really stand.
And the latest low blow is to start a whispering, and this came from Marty Wilson, who is the campaign director for Fiorina, and in a reported telephone conversation with former Secretary of State and State Senator Bruce McPherson. McPherson says that Wilson said, "Why are you supporting Campbell? He's anti-Semitic." Now, this is an issue that I know very well about Campbell because it came up in 2000, and many people were attacking him because he has been even-handed about the issues between Israel and the Palestinians. And he, at times, has voted against excessive aid to Israel. But he is not anti-Israel. What he wants is the U.S. to be an honest broker for peace between these two parties. And it's being twisted, and we can just imagine what kind of hits Fiorina has planned against Campbell on this issue. And it's really sad to see them descend so far so early in the campaign.
Well, I think it's sad, absolutely, and it's also typical of the way these, you know, corporate right-wingers like Whitman and Fiorina plan to run their campaigns. Fiorina, in particular, has really nothing to offer Californians. She has no real record of success. She doesn't really have any clear vision for how to improve our economy, aside from, again, mass layoffs. So it makes it very easy for Fiorina, in particular, to run this very vicious and nasty campaign against Campbell. It's a sign of what she'll try to do against Barbara Boxer. I wouldn't be surprised if she tried to call Barbara Boxer anti-Semitic, even though Boxer herself is Jewish.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I there is a third candidate named DeVore, who is an Orange County Republican, hard right, And he is hoping that Campbell and Fiorina will split the vote and somehow he can sail through. But I think it's more likely that DeVore will draw from Fiorina. And there is a slight chance that Campbell could win the primary. Tom's biggest weakness is that he's very poor at raising money. And when he ran in 2000, he only raised, both for the primary and general, about $3 million. And in California, that's a week and a half of television. So it remains to be seen if he can turn that around or if his new friend, the governor, will help raise money for Campbell and keep him in the game. But I think that he's hoping that he can squeak through the primary and then hope to get Republican money for a race against Boxer in the fall.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the thinking for Campbell. He feels if he can survive the primary, then he might be able to draw some national money against Barbara Boxer. You know, it is an open question of whether Campbell can survive this primary. Chuck DeVore is not getting very much traction at all. He has a lot of support from the party's right-wing base, from the teabaggers who are always part of the Republican base, always have been. But even so, he's getting, you know, low single digits in some of the polling that we've seen. He's having a very difficult time raising money himself. So it really is, I think, going to come down largely to Fiorina and Campbell. Fiorina's campaign understands that, and that's why they're making these vicious and often ridiculous attacks on Tom Campbell. Because they believe that's the only way they're going to be able to defeat someone who, even though I don't support Campbell either, Campbell is much more qualified for this position than Carly Fiorina is.
Indeed. I certainly agree with you on both counts. Now, the other factor here is the Roberts Court decision to lift any limits on corporate spending on independent expenditures. And no matter who the Republican nominee is in the fall, he or she will have no control over big coal, big oil, and those who oppose Boxer's initiatives on climate change and cap and trade. They will spend huge amounts of money to vilify her and to bring up her negatives. And she's always had a problem with her negatives. When she was in the House, she was a shrill, edgy, somewhat annoying liberal. She's moderated that as senator, and I give her a lot of credit for reducing some of the sharp edges and sharp elbows that she was known for in the House. But my fear is we're going to see unprecedented independent expenditure spending against Boxer in the fall. And she and even with labor backing and even if Stephen Bing writes big checks to Democratic independent expenditure campaigns, I think that that could really spell the difference.
Yeah, it'll be a really tough battle. I'm confident that Boxer can win re-election, but it's going to be a real titanic battle. It'll resemble, I think, the 1994 U.S. Senate race here in California between Dianne Feinstein and Michael Huffington. Michael Huffington, a right-wing Republican, at the time married to Arianna Huffington.
Oh, indeed, yeah.
And who's gone on to become a very progressive woman herself, founded Huffington Post. Back in the 1990s, though, Huffington is still married to Michael, who engaged against Dianne Feinstein in what was at the time the most expensive U.S. Senate election in history. Feinstein won a very close, narrow victory in 1994. I suspect that's how it's going to play out here in California as well. The difference is, and the difference between the gubernatorial race here in California, is that Boxer understands this. She's going to run a very smart campaign. Boxer has been raising money since 2007 for this re-election bid. She's very well aware of the work she'll have to do to get re-elected, and I think she will have very little problem getting the kind of progressive activist support that she really needs because she has been such a strong voice on a wide range of issues, including the banks. She called for Bernanke to not be reconfirmed as chairman of the Federal Reserve. She's called for restoring the Glass-Steagall law regulating banks. She's a very progressive person. She understands where the electorate is at. And I think Boxer is going to be a very formidable opponent for any Republican who runs against her.
You mentioned Michael Huffington, and I have the distinction of having one of the last interviews with him when he was running in 1994. He failed miserably to get his point across in my one-hour adventure with him. And his advisors didn't let him do any more radio interviews after that. And at the station where I was, we had an autograph wall. And halfway through the one-hour interview during a commercial break, He went out and signed the autograph wall, and he said, I'm having a great time, ... so far. I want to talk about the initiative process in California and what the Pacific Gas and Electric Company is trying to do with a very pernicious anti-democratic ballot measure. It's Proposition 16. They have spent $6.5 million on it. They notified their shareholders that they're prepared to spend $30 to $50 million on it and that it may depress profits in the coming year. And what they're trying to do is snuff out what is a very infant approach to adding local utilities that could buy renewable resource-based power and try to reduce our reliance on nuclear and combustible sources like natural gas. And I'm in Marin County, where we have the Marin Energy Authority, which is based on this law that was passed a few years ago that permits what's called community choice aggregation. And essentially, we can band together and choose to buy power from renewable resources. PG&E will deliver it, and we pay the bill to them. But what we're going to be doing is shifting the mix that's on the grid, and I support that. But PG&E is trying to kill the local effort here in Marin County, and in a larger effort, they're trying to pass this ballot measure that would require any community that wants to do this in the future to have a two-thirds vote by the public, a referendum with a supermajority, before it could happen. And I believe this is a bully tactic by an existing monopolist that is not content with the monopoly they have.
Well, I think that's right. And if you just have to look at the United States Senate to see the failure of supermajority rules like this. And what PG&E is doing is obvious. They're using the rates we pay to them, that we have to pay, because there really, in most parts of Northern California, is no other alternative to get our gas and electric service than PG&E. They take our money, spend it on these ballot initiatives designed to deny our ability to choose to find locally sourced renewable energy. It's completely pernicious and completely ridiculous, and it's part of this larger battle that's shaping up here in 2010 in California over corporate power. There is another initiative put out by a large corporation on the June ballot, Proposition 17, mm-hmm. by Mercury Insurance, which would undermine some of the consumer protections for auto insurance. They could be able to charge people up to double premiums if they are uncovered by insurance, if they lose their coverage for even a day, an hour, a week. That's contrasting against Proposition 15, which is a California Clean Money initiative designed to demonstrate the effectiveness of public financing by creating public financing for the Secretary of State race in 2014 and 2018.
Mm-hmm.
And when you put that all together with the battles we're having over health care reform, with health insurance companies wanting to raise rates by 40% on people, and Meg Whitman, Carly Fiorina, these corporate CEOs wanting to take over our state, it becomes very clear that 2010 is a year where Californians will decide whether we're going to have genuine democracy, the ability to choose our own economic path, to choose how we have renewable energy, to choose how we deliver health care, or are we going to let these large corporations decide for us? That's really the choice facing Californians in 2010.
And Robert, last week, the San Francisco Chronicle, in an ironic placement of two stories, had one that reported comments by our Chief Justice, a Republican named Ron George, who was raising serious questions about the initiative process and the way it's been turned on its ear. He said, you know, it was designed to offset the power of the Southern Pacific Railroad back at the turn of the preceding century, and instead it's now a tool for corporate interests to bypass the legislature and impose very self-interest standards and policies and legislation. And you turned the page, and there was the story about PG&E notifying its shareholders about how much money it's ready to spend on the proposition we just mentioned. Do you think there's any way to reform the process? We saw that there was an effort to call a constitutional convention, but they had to close up shop because the professional firms, the signature-gathering firms, gathered together and refused to deal with them. And so they could not get the signatures that they needed. They couldn't afford to buy them by bringing people in from out of state to stand at the supermarket and gather those signatures. This is an amazing turn of events.
Well, I think that's right, and it shows just how badly we need reform, not just in California, but nationwide. And I really think one of the top progressive priorities over the coming decade has to be a constitutional amendment to the U.S. Constitution. First, saying that money does not equal speech, that Congress has the power to ban corporate campaign contributions of any kind, and also an amendment that goes further and denies corporations personhood, denies them the protections of the Bill of Rights, for example, that they've been using as cover to basically assert themselves over our democratic processes like this. It's going to take a lot of progressive organizing to make that happen, and it has to be nationwide, but I think it's got to be one of the top priorities.
And just as a footnote, I think the Chief Justice Ron George feels personally singed, if not burned, by the special interests who paid for Proposition 8, which overturned the decision that he authored by the Supreme Court just a few months before that, that said there is a constitutional right for same-sex couples to marry. And so he saw that overturned, and then I can't quite rationalize why he voted with the majority to declare Proposition 8 legal.
Yeah, I can't either. I think Ron George's decision and opinion in the Prop 8 case upholding Prop 8 was very deeply flawed. But he is correct when he speaks out against the way the initiative process works right now in California. And I think we need to not only reform the initiative process, but we really need national reform of corporate practices and certainly of our elections and who funds the elections.
Robert, thanks for your time today. Great to catch up on all these California issues and help people outside of the Golden State understand what's going on here.
Thanks for having me on.
Robert Cruickshank, read him at calitix.org and check out Courage it's calitix.com, couragecampaign.org. There we go. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. I'd like to hear your comments. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.